Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's practice group Teleforum conference call as today, March 25th, 2021, we discuss the outer reaches of the unitary executive theory and the termination of EEOC General Counsel Sharon Gustafson. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Very pleased to welcome our audience and our guests today. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast and will likely be transcribed and put on our website in the future. I mentioned three guests. We're very pleased to have each of them with us. I'm going to introduce them very briefly, and then we'll get opening remarks in turn from each of them, not more than 10 minutes or so. And then, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions. So we'll hear first from the Honorable Sharon Fast Gustafson. She's the former General Counsel of the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She'll be followed by G. Roger King. He's the Senior Labor and Employment Counsel at HR Policy Association. And then we'll get remarks from the Honorable Neil Eggleston, who's a partner at Kirkland & Ellis right here in Washington, D.C. But as I mentioned, as always, we'll be looking for audience questions, so have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Sharon Gustafson, the floor is yours.
Hello. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I very much enjoyed my work as General Counsel of the EEOC. After 28 years practicing employment law, I was honored to have a turn working on the inside of the EEOC. And this experience has certainly helped me better understand how the agency operates. I respected and enjoyed the career employees, most of them were lawyers, whom I worked with, and I had a great group of political staff working with me. I'm not taking a position today on the legal issues related to President Biden's decision to fire me on March 5. More than 2 years shy of my four-year term. I leave that discussion to the others. But I have agreed to share my thoughts about the pragmatic question of whether presidents should terminate the presidentially appointed and Senate-confirmed political employees who have fixed terms. In my opinion, after having served in such a position, absent some truly unusual reason, both political parties would do well to promptly confirm political nominees so that both parties can have maximum influence over the agency when it's their turn. And then both parties should respect the term limits of those confirmed. It is not healthy for career agency employees to become detached from the political process to which they are supposed to be accountable. But they do become detached in the absence of political leadership. They rightly think that they are the subject matter experts. So they wrongly think that they are the people who should make policy judgments. Policy judgments should be made, rather, by those chosen by the voters to make those judgments. Understandably, perhaps, the career employees tend to regard the political appointees who are their rightful temporary leaders as visitors and interruptions that need to be tolerated. In any discipline, the experts may become so expert that they begin to lose contact with business reality and everyday reality in their work. I doubt whether even a handful of EEOC attorneys have ever owned or run a business or made payroll. I expect that few of them have substantial experience advising a business. Many of them have spent their entire careers at the EEOC. They are smart and personable and expert. But they do not know what it's like to be an employer who is responsible both to its shareholders as well as to its employees whose livelihoods depend on the success of the business. Nor do they know what it is like to advise an employee who is experiencing discrimination, to help her attempt to remedy matters with her employer, and then to represent her through the filing and investigation of a charge of discrimination, through a mediation or conciliation, through the filing of a lawsuit, through discovery and summary judgment proceedings, and through trial and appeal, and hopefully settlement. Most of the political appointees, on the other hand, have at least some of that experience, and some of us have all of it. The EEOC commissioners, even the Democrat-appointed commissioners, reflect a real-world orientation that probably arises in part from their political situations. They tend to be more hesitant to push things as far left as possible. They may be more alert to the social and political ramifications of an extreme position than are the career employees. Democrats may think they do not care because the agencies tend left when no one is at the helm. But Democrats should want agencies to have political oversight. David Lopez, the EEOC's general counsel under President Obama, was definitely influential in innovative work the agency did during his tenure. Both political parties have an interest in getting their appointees confirmed as soon as possible and in keeping them in their positions for the duration of their terms. My point is that thoughtful people from the left and from the right should value the place of political appointees in the running of an agency. If both parties follow President Biden's approach, they will minimize the role of appointees with statutory terms and expand the power of an unelected and self-governing bureaucracy. And now I'm going to hand it over to Roger King for his remarks.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you, Dean and Neil. Good to join with you this morning. From my perspective, this is both a policy and legal discussion. Let's start with policy just for a moment. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, by congressional design, is an independent agency. Congress has spoken on that issue. I think that's well understood and accepted. It's not part of the Department of Labor controlled. It's an independent agency. And if you go back to basics and look at the creation of the commission and the composition of the commissioners on the commission and also its general counsel, I think that point is statutorily well made. For example, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commissioners shall be no more than three from one political party. And if you look at the EEOC website, you'll see on a number of occasions, the commission states it's a bipartisan, apolitical entity. And those are important points to remember. Also, as Sharon mentioned, we're talking about specific terms. This is a position of general counsel that has a specific term. Again, going back to the statute, the statute's quite clear that the GC of the EEOC has a four-year term. The word shall appears in the same sentence as the advice and consent requirements for the Senate. So we're talking about an agency that is independent, apolitical, and nonpartisan. And that's the framework I think this discussion should keep in mind as we proceed through various legal issues. The second point I would make is no president, Democrat or Republican, has ever removed an EEOC general counsel. This is completely unprecedented. And the reasons for that, while their Office of Legal Counsel memorandum that discuss inherent presidential authority, for sound policy reasons, no general counsel, again, has ever been removed by a president, as was the case that we're talking about today. And I think that speaks volumes. It is not wise. It is not good public policy for the chief executive or those close to him or her to become so involved in an independent agency as to make it a political branch of the office of the president. That is not the way we should be running independent agencies and commissions. Let's talk for a moment about the duties of the EEOC General Counsel. I think you can distill them basically into three distinct roles. The GC serves as the commission's lawyer. Second, as the commission's prosecutor in the courts, and as administrative officer working with the chair of the commission regarding supervision of lawyers in the field offices of the commission. This is not a policy-making position. This is, as many would describe, an inferior officer position. And that's a discussion that we've not seen or heard. But there's ample Supreme Court authority, particularly the Morrison case, that discusses inferior officers. And I would submit that the general counsel of the EEOC is an inferior officer as discussed by the courts. And this particular position does not have regular interaction with the office of the president, the vice president, or others in the White House. It is removed from that, and for good reason. Now, there's been all kinds of discussion about recent case law. And I want to just talk first, though, about the general counsel of other agencies. If you do some research, you'll find that there are only three general counsels of independent agencies and boards that require Senate confirmation. One is the National Labor Relations Board, two is the Federal Labor Relations Authority, and three is the EEOC General Counsel. Statutes are silent at the NRA and at the EEOC with respect to the power of the president to remove. The president's not given specific authority, certainly not at-will authority. The statutes are silent regarding NLRB General Counsel and EEOC General Counsel. However, the Congress was quite clear with respect to the Federal Labor Relations Authority, the most recent pronouncement by the Congress with respect to general counsel removal. There, the Congress clearly provided the president, the chief executive, with at-will authority to remove the GC, the Federal Labor Relations Authority. So Congress knows how to speak on this issue if it so desires to give at-will authority. It did not do so with respect to the EEOC general counsel. And finally, I should mention the Scalia law case. It's really interesting. We have an almost complete change of position by many in Washington after President Trump removed the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There was a substantial pushback and then Supreme Court litigation. And many, I'm sure, of Neil's colleagues took the position that the president did not have authority to remove the individual heading this agency. Well, the Supreme Court, of course, concluded otherwise. But it's interesting, if you really drill into that decision, what the court looked at was the considerable authority that the director of that bureau had. Indeed, there were 19 separate consumer protection statutes that the individual in that position had authority to promulgate rules and also enforce. That's not the case of the general counsel of the EEOC. She or he works closely with the commission, as I mentioned, has three distinct types of duties. So in conclusion here, notwithstanding the unprecedented nature of what occurred, this is a very poor policy decision. We think the Supreme Court decisions in Humphreys and Weiner and in Morrison clearly support a legal challenge to what has occurred here. And at a minimum, we think it would be helpful to have clear Supreme Court guidance on this issue. Neil, let me turn it to you.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Very much appreciate it. So this is Neil Eggleston. I was introduced as a partner at Kirkland & Ellis. I was also White House counsel for the last 3 years of the Obama administration, which I thought I probably should mention since people are probably wondering sort of what my point of view is here. Let me just say that it's my view that President Biden properly terminated Sharon, both as a matter of law and as a matter of policy. Let me start. Roger talks about the EEOC as being an independent agency. I guess that's a little bit of a definitional issue, and I'm not sure it really matters. The members of the commissioners on the EEOC are all appointed for a term of years. And typically when we think about independent agencies, they are protected by for-cause removal provisions. And it's important to note that the EEOC general counsel is also appointed for a term of years, but does not have for-cause removal provisions in the statute. And so the legal argument has to be that for some reason, the fact that the general counsel is appointed to a term of years means that the president cannot terminate her before that term of years is over. I think the law is overwhelmingly against that argument. First, let me just point out that Director Comey, director of the FBI, who was terminated by President Trump, he was serving a 10-year term. I don't remember any conservative commentators. I may have missed some. I don't read all conservative commentators, but I certainly don't remember a big outcry that Director Comey could not be fired because he was serving a term of years. I think at the time it was generally regarded that the president could terminate him because there was not a for-cause removal provision. So I think the litigation over presidential termination has typically been over the for-cause removal provision. And I really think, again, I may have missed some, but there is not case law that supports the view that being appointed for a term of years insulates the appointee from termination. I think that more accepted view is that the term of years is intended as a limit so that someone cannot continue to serve without being renominated and reconfirmed. It's certainly, as we all know, true with the FBI director, because Director Hoover had been in that position so long that eventually when he was replaced, they wanted to make sure that there was a limit on how long he could serve. And so they put the directors could serve. People remember Myers, which is the case from, I think, from the 20s out of the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court struck down a provision that said that the Senate had a role in the termination of someone who was a postmaster general of the United States. Roger mentioned the Sela Law case, which was decided last June, I guess, by the Supreme Court. He's right. It was about for-cause termination of the director of the CFPB. Supreme Court ruled that that was a limitation on the president's ability to terminate that was unconstitutional. So let's just be clear. There was a for-cause termination provision in the CFPB statute for the director, and the Supreme Court ruled that that for-cause termination provision was unconstitutional because it was a restriction on the power of the president to terminate him. Let me just say this would be a very odd case indeed if the Supreme Court thought that it was striking down the for-cause provision, but that the director still remained in place because he had a term of years. Remember, the director of the CFPB had a five-year term of years, and there's certainly no one in that position was taking the position in that case. I'm sorry, was taking the position that the term of years protected the director of the CFPB. I just want to look. Justice Kagan had what I thought was a powerful dissent in Sela Law, but the dissent was a discussion again of the provision for a for-cause termination that the majority had struck down. You know, as I sort of hear these arguments, I'm feeling a little bit as if conservatives think that the unitary executive applies to Republican presidents but does not apply to Democratic presidents. And I think the law here is quite clear that a term of years does not protect the general counsel of the EEOC or the other agencies from termination by the president. The similar issue has come up. I know it's not the subject of this, with regard to the general counsel of the NLRB, who does not have a for-cause termination provision in his the statute creating his position. The members of the NLRB do. Some conservatives have argued that since he works closely with the NLRB, that he should get for-cause termination provisions just as they have. That would be a pretty wacky reading of the statute to read for-cause into his termination provisions when Congress elected not to keep it in. So that's sort of my legal analysis. I hear Roger, he's a super smart guy, but I would say that this is not a particularly close case. I might say, I know that Sharon didn't address the legal issues. Maybe she will now that I've weighed in. But I've read her letter to President Biden refusing to resign. I don't see a citation to any legal support that the president does not have legal authority to terminate her. She talks about breach of norms and all sorts of things, but she does not cite to a case other than or anything else other than the term of year provision in support of the view that the president cannot terminate her. Roger mentioned, and maybe Sharon also mentioned, that Sharon was the first general counsel to have been terminated. let me just say, at least the last two general counsels resigned when a president of the other party was elected. I think we all know that this is quite common. The chairman of the SEC, for example, who as a member of the SEC has for cause removal protection, typically resigns. That the head of the FTC typically resigns because there's a recognition that the president should get his people into those positions. I know they could probably stay on as members under the statutes. They can't really stay on as chairs because the statute gives that power to the president to select. In Sharon's letter to President Biden refusing to resign, the only example she cites, actually, of a general counsel of the EEOC staying on was the transition from the Ford administration to the Carter administration in the late 1970s. I don't know enough about that specific episode to know whether there was a reason for it, but it may be true that the EEOC general counsels have not typically been fired, but you can tell from this record that they have typically resigned as well and have not done what Sharon decided to do sort of in this matter. Finally, just as a policy matter, look, I completely agree with Sharon that that the Senate should be addressing these nominations and deciding on them very quickly. And the fact that they take years, I mean, here we are with President Biden, he's gone fairly quickly. But here we are with President Biden, who knows, you never know whether you're going to have a 4-year term or an 8-year, you know, an 8 years of a presidency. But I completely agree it's important to have political leadership, and I completely agree it's important to get people in quickly, and that political leadership has an important role in all these different agencies. What I disagree with is the notion that there should be some presumption that the nominee appointed by the president, in this case, the president who was defeated in a re-election, that nominee should be permitted to remain in office and, I think, perpetuate the policies of the prior president. I think Sharon made a reference to the choice by the voters. Well, the voters in the United States last November made a decision to reject President Trump and to elect President Biden. And I think it's completely consistent with the unitary executive and with the prerogatives of the president to put in people who support his positions and not people who support the positions of President Trump as general counsel of the agency. Dean, I'm done. And with my opening remarks, I may have prompted some questions along the way, I'll turn it back to you.
Terrific. Thanks to all three of you. I do want to open the floor to questions from the audience at this point, although I have some ideas about some questions of my own, but let's do that. So while we wait to let people queue up, I want to also give Sharon and I don't want to go through the order again, but I want to give a chance for some responses here. And Sharon and Roger, as you respond, there's an interesting thought experiment I've had with regard to presidential power, executive power, and that would be to ask the question, well, let's just assume a president makes an appointment to one of these boards or commissions or a GC position. There's no change in presidency, but can the president then fire their own person? In other words, let's just say President Biden appoints Joe Smith to be the new EEOC GC. Does President Biden have the power to remove that person? And are we focusing too much on a change of administration? And for Neil, I'd ask, this is not necessarily a legal question, but it goes to the norms and traditions, I suppose, and some of the policy implications. I put a lot of stock in the difficulty in getting people to serve in the federal government, whether it's, you know, in the main executive branch or an independent agency. I'm reluctant to make reliance interest, but I also think some people agree to serve because they imagine they'll be in a position for the full term. Indeed, a lot of times they're asked if they basically agree to serve the entire term, in addition to providing some continuity in the office. which I think is probably a good thing. It sets expectations, and it makes it easier, I think, to attract highly qualified people, that they, especially late in an administration with an election results unknown, you're going to try and recruit somebody to fill a position that might be a key position for 9 months, which can be a hard sell, which might be another reason that some of these have terms. So with that, let me go back and we do have some questions from the audience, but let me give Sharon a chance to reply and respond to anything that I've mentioned or her colleagues have mentioned on the phone.
I've never before thought about whether or not the president who appointed me could have terminated me. I guess I assumed that he could have, but I never gave any thought to it. I do understand the arguments on both sides, and it's kind of fun to hear people arguing both sides of this question. But for me, I have just really been interested in the pragmatic questions about whether it's a good idea. I also note, as somebody who's been an employment lawyer for decades, just in employment law generally, and I'm not saying it applies in this situation, but generally, one of the things we tell employees is when you have an employment agreement that's for a period of years, it takes cause to terminate you. That's the difference between at-will employment and employment for a term of years. And with at-will employment, you can be terminated for any reason, but if it's for a term of years, you won't be terminated unless there's cause. So, again, I never represented anybody who had been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, and I haven't given any thought. It didn't occur to me until this conversation today that's true, and how does that apply here? But it is interesting, and it's sort of in the back of my mind about how it works when you have a job for a term of years. But I do think that there just should be an incentive. The four-year term gives an incentive to the political system to get people confirmed early on. And if you know, the new president can just fire this person, then there's no reason for everybody for opponents not to just drag their feet and try to hold up these confirmations as long as possible to shorten the term and any influence that appointee may have.
So, Dean, just two quick points. One, I'm going to go back to the statute. Let me just read it. There shall be a general counsel of the commission appointed by the president, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, for a term of 4 years, period. Couldn't be any clearer. The one case that has come closest to analyzing this issue involved the EEOC commissioner who sued to be reinstated, somewhat similar to your question, Dean. But I want to just read one quick passage from this case. It's Lewis v. Carter. It's, for those listening, 436 FedSup 958. It's a 1977 decision of the Federal District Court of the District of Columbia. And here's the quote. However, it is apparent that the EEOC does possess a quantity of functions which are legislative or judicial in character, including information collection and dissemination and the issuance of advisory opinions. The question, of course, is where to draw the line between executive and non-executive agencies. Should only those officials and agencies with purely executive functions be subject to removal at the will of the president? Or should the test be whether the agency in question has functions which are only predominantly executive? The Supreme Court has left the question open. And there's some OLC opinions that come to the same conclusion. This is a close call. It's an open question. And just to respond to Neil's points, the director of the FBI, the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau have far greater duties and responsibilities, particularly policy-wise, than the general counsel of the EEOC. I don't think it's an even close comparison. And when you really unpack the decision that Scalia, including some very thoughtful dissents that Neil mentioned, I think it's clear that when you apply the Humphrey's executive functions and duties test, the position of EEOC general counsel doesn't come close to an executive level policymaking position. This is not only uncertain territory of law where the Supreme Court should step in and clarify Humphrey's executor, but it also is exceedingly poor policy. Can we imagine a president calling the general counsel of the EEOC and saying, don't move aggressively against this company or this employer or this union. That's not what we want. That's not good policy. This agency is independent. It is by statute bipartisan, as I mentioned at the top of this call. It should remain that way. And I don't think this is a Republican or Democrat discussion. I think it's about good government. I think it's about independent agencies doing what they're supposed to do without inappropriate interference from the chief executive.
So, Dean, Neil, just a really couple of thoughts. You sort of, I think, floated to me the question about reliance interest. And look, I just think on that if somebody's being nominated at the end of a term, then the person has to think to themselves, I might not be able to serve out at the end of a presidential term, that I may not be able to serve out the rest of my time. Obviously, President Trump largely filled his, not largely is too strong, but heavily filled his administration with people who were acting and decided not to nominate them at all, even when the Senate was controlled by Republicans. And I think that anybody thinking about reliance interests just has to think to themselves, if a president from another party is elected, then I'm going to lose my job. And that's part of being in a political system where you get nominated by a president and confirmed by the Senate. And I really don't buy the sort of the term of years issue. And let me just say this sort of interesting. I have such whipsaw. You know, at least Thomas and Gorsuch and maybe others, and certainly the SG's office in the Department of Justice, all urged the Supreme Court to overrule Humphrey's executor. So the conservative view of this is that Humphrey's executor should be overruled and there should not be protection even for independent agency commissioners. And I just can't get over the thought that what's going on with this is a view that it's okay as long as it's a Republican president, but when it's a Democratic president, we want to constrain his ability. And let me just say on the Lewis v. Carter case, I just think the Supreme Court has a very different view of this now than it did in 1970, than the district court did in 1977, and that if anything, they didn't need to decide the Humphrey's executor issue in order to decide the CFPB case because he was a single member. But I really don't know where the case is going to go if they present one that presents multi member commissions. Obviously, some members of the Supreme Court have made it quite clear. A lot of conservative commentary has been that Humphrey's executor should be overturned. It seems to me, if anything, that's the way the law, that's where the fight is. It's not over whether people who have a term of years should be protected. I really think there's no support for that at all.
Very good. We do have a couple callers with questions. Go ahead, caller.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Paige Smith. I'm a reporter with Bloomberg Law. I have a question for Ms. Fast Gustafson. Are you planning on taking any legal action over your termination?
I don't have any plans. I'm keeping all my options open. As Neil has pointed out today, I haven't been making legal arguments in this call or in my letter. I'm just listening to other people make those arguments. I agree that we need Supreme Court guidance, and I agree that whatever the rule is, it should apply to both parties. And nobody will hear me saying that there should be two different rules depending on who's in office, what party's in office.
Thank you.
We've got one question left. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Pepper Crutcher. I'm the current practice group chairman, and let me first say thank you very much for Neil Eggleston's thoughtful presentation that actually may have changed my mind to some extent about this. But I have a pointy head statutory construction question that's separate and apart from unitary executive analysis. And I want to direct it to Roger King. So, Roger, as Sharon said, those of us on the management side have been fighting the at-will employment wars for 30, 40 years. And to my knowledge, it is the common law of all the states that a contract for a definite term is terminable only for a cause, and the at-will cases go off on what about contracts of indefinite duration, to what extent is cause required. So my question is, for federal statutory construction purposes, does it matter what the uniform underlying law of the states is? Should that be considered when construing a federal statute? Assuming you think the federal statute is ambiguous, has the underlying common law of the states been considered in other contexts for purpose of interpreting a federal statute? There's my question, Roger.
Thanks, Pepper. Great question. Well, it certainly should inform the discussion. The Supreme Court, though, has been very clear on the silence of the statutes. It has said that's not an issue. The Supreme Court has gotten past that and looked to the functions and duties test. But per your question, no, I think it's something that's worthy of statutory construction discussion. At-will employment is a very severe and contested doctrine, as you know, and to provide the decision maker with absolutely unbridled authority to remove someone is very contentious. Our friends on the labor side of this discussion would push back and argue for a cause. And that's what's somewhat interesting about the political consequences of this discussion. We saw a lot of pushback against President Trump's removal of the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And now we have a complete role reversal by some of the same individuals supporting President Biden. This can't continue. It shouldn't continue. So again, back to your question. Yes, I think that the common law in this area should be considered. The at-will doctrine is one that certainly should be looked at. But ultimately, Pepper, I think it's a functions and duties test. I think Humphrey's executor was properly decided and should be clarified.
Neil or Sharon, anything on this point?
Not for me.
Yeah, it's Neil. So just on the, so this is a super interesting question, Pepper, but just a couple of thoughts on it, which is one, I think it's very hard to separate the functions and duties test from statutes that have for-cause removal provisions. So we just haven't seen case law applying it simply to a term of years. Now I'm talking about in the federal system, not the employment law context. And that's the issue. That's where this has come up. As I say, there was no weight in CELA law. There was no sort of second argument that because he was also serving a term of years that there, you know, that he had some additional protection. It was because he had this for-cause termination provision. And I guess, Pepper, the other thing I would just distinguish from the employment situation, the regular employment situation, and I do sound like a, you know, like a conservative when I say this, but the essentially the argument is that the vesting clause vests the executive power in the President of the United States, and the take care clause, you know, requires him to execute the laws of the United States. And the argument from Myers and the argument in the CELA law is that in order to do that, he needs to have hiring and firing authority. And unless he can control employees, and remember the general counsel, the EEOC, this isn't just some employee somewhere in the bowels of the administration. This is someone who's nominated by the President of the United States. And so this isn't some low-level employee here. And the notion is that the president needs to be in a position to be able to terminate that person if the person is not acting appropriately. And Dean, to go back to your question, I don't think it matters whether it's a new president. I think if the president decides that the person is not discharging the function the way the president intended, that the president can terminate that person. I don't remember there were term of years terminations except Comey by President Trump, but he sure terminated a lot of people. And I don't think anybody thought there was much of a reliance interest, except for Comey. I can't think of a good example of someone who's terminated through a term of years, though. Acknowledge that.
And Neil, let me ask you a quick follow-up. But we've got four questions in the queue, but does it make a difference in your estimation whether or not we're talking about an independent, quote-unquote, agency or a cabinet-level agency in terms of the president's ability to fire them or replace them?
I'm in the camp that agrees with Humphrey's executor and believe that it should not be overturned. And I would like to see CELA law limited to the specific sort of circumstance of a single director. So I don't think that the President of the United States should be able to terminate the SEC commissioners and I think Humphrey's executor was an FTC situation, or the FTC.
Correct.
I don't know. Look, I haven't looked into it carefully, but I don't know that it's fair to call the EEOC an independent agency. I know that Roger's taking that position. I'm not really disagreeing, but most of the agencies that we think of as independent agencies have for-cause termination protection, and the commissioners of the EEOC do not. So part of my answer to you, Dean, is I agree generally, and I think Humphrey's executor should remain in force and not be overturned by the Supreme Court. But I'm not sure that that applies to the EEOC, but I haven't looked at it carefully. I acknowledge that.
Very interesting. We've got four questions pending, so let's move on now to go right ahead, caller.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Great panel. Very interesting. Appreciate all the panelists very much. So my question is for Mr. Eggleston, and I'm trying to make sense of a lot of these cases myself. So my question is, if I'm hearing you correctly, aren't for-cause protections actually illusory and unenforceable? In other words, if a president says this quasi-judicial NLRB member or EEOC commissioner has issued substantive decisions on legal issues that I don't like, that constitutes good cause for removal under my executive power. And if there is essentially unlimited removal power, doesn't this destroy the advice and consent power of the Senate and undercut a very important check and balance in the Constitution?
Let me do the second one first. I'm a little worried your first question is going to fall out of my head. So I may have an answer to it, but it just may fall out of my head. When you give me two, you know, at my age, it's so hard to keep it both in my head. but the advice of consent issue is basically present whether there's any protection. It's the same thing as on a cabinet official where, and that's really Myers. And, you know, it wasn't obvious Myers had to come out that way. There's nothing in the Constitution that says anything about termination. But Myers said, despite a statute that said the postmaster general of whatever state he was in couldn't be terminated without essentially Senate consent, the Supreme Court said no, that the president gets to do that, and that statute's unconstitutional. I think Myers was unanimous, if I'm remembering correctly. So I think that in some ways that's just where we are on the state of the law, and the Supreme Court enthusiastically reaffirmed Myers in the CELA law case. But could you give me the first one again? Because I had an answer to it.
Yeah, the first one was, I mean, if the president has unlimited removal power, then what does for cause mean? Because the president can just say, gee, you issued anti-union decisions or you issued pro-union decisions, so you're out of here. Even though you're a quasi-judicial official in an independent agency, you're out of here. And that constitutes for cause. So that's the question.
I get it. No, look, this is an interesting question, and it was sort of debated during the argument in the CELA law case, which I listened to. My partner Paul Clement was appointed to defend the law because the Trump administration obviously had decided not to defend the law, and I think actually not in CELA law, but in the D.C. Circuit opinion that was written by Judge Kavanaugh that dealt with essentially the same issue. I think Judge Wilkins makes a similar argument. And the argument essentially is that the for-cause protection is not much of a protection. And essentially the argument you just made, I think the Supreme Court didn't resolve that and didn't have to resolve it in CELA law. I think most people think that for cause means something more than I disagree with, you know, sort of the substance of your position. But I think that that was an issue that came up in the CELA law argument, oral argument, and maybe even the briefs. I haven't read the briefs, but I listened to the argument, sort of basically arguing, we're not sure what the content of, so the president can't just wake up one morning on a whim and do it, but as long as the president has a sort of articulated reason that sort of that's sufficient. I've heard that argument. I suspect there's a fair amount of case law that suggests that it has more teeth than that, but that's not a, that's a, that's something that got a lot of attention, I think, in the CELA law argument.
Roger or Sharon, anything on this point?
I would just say about the four cause issue, generally in employment law, either that's four causes defined by the contract itself, or there's an assumption that there's some sort of malfeasance or neglect. Severe neglect. It's not just somebody who has a difference of opinion. And I just wanted to make the point that during my tenure at the EEOC, it was the career employees whom I heard feeling strongly about the fact that the EEOC is an independent agency. I found the question interesting, and I still do.
Just another thought here, Dean.
Roger,
I'd like to focus on the Morrison the Olson case, a Supreme Court decision in 1988. And there, I think the court really properly framed our discussion. It said the controlling question is whether removal protections are of such a nature that they impede the president's ability to perform his or her constitutional duties. And there, the court upheld the constitutional removal protections for an independent counsel. And noted that the independent counsel position had structured jurisdiction and lacked policymaking or significant policymaking authority. And I really think we need to put that in the equation here and look at, again, the functions and duties of the general counsel. Yes, I understand the unitary executive approach. I may agree with Neil as to its contours to a point, but I don't think there's any debate that the general counsel does not have significant policymaking authority. It's back to the three essential functions or duties of that position. And we can't lose sight of that. We should have career people taking the position that Sharon just mentioned. I know it's frustrating sometimes for those of us that are working with the new administration to have pushback from career people. But that's the way our system is set up. If the Congress had intended an at-will termination authority here, as I mentioned at the outset, it did so in the Federal Labor Relations Authority General Counsel statute. It could have so stated. It didn't so state. And the Supreme Court's been very clear on this, that the silence of removal is not an impediment for protection here. I mean, I'm clear on that in my research. And I know we had a question that really gets into the National Labor Relations Board, which is a different discussion, but similar. So I don't think that's really the issue. I think the issue, again, is Humphrey's executor duties and functions, Supreme Court then elaborated further in CELA law.
Hey, Dean, could I weigh in? It's Neil, just on the Morrison v. Olson point.
Of course, go right ahead.
I mean, just sort of two thoughts, which is, you know, one is conservatives basically this is such a weird conversation, have completely adopted the Scalia dissent. The Scalia to the extent that people are now seeming to think that the Scalia dissent, and he was by himself in dissent, the majority is written by Rehnquist, he said that the independent counsel performed executive functions, that the vesting clause vests executive functions in the president of the United States, and therefore the independent counsel statute was unconstitutional. It was pretty simple for him, and my general sense is that the conservative unitary executive people have essentially adopted the Scalia dissent as almost controlling law. The other thing about Morrison that you just have to remember is the independent counsel was not someone nominated by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. I mean, we keep talking about how this person has very little function and no policy. It's someone who, under the statute, has to be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. This is a very high-ranking official. The independent counsel in Morrison v. Olson, the independent counsel was Alexia Morrison, was selected by three judges who were part of a panel that did it, and lightly supervised by the attorney general and removable for cause by the attorney general. So much further down in the hierarchy than someone who's been nominated by the president and confirmed. So I really don't think that Morrison v. Olson is much support for someone at such a senior level as Sharon had. And can I just say one other thing, Sharon, which is you know, I disagree with you about whether you should have been fired, but people used to say to me when I was done, thank you for your service. And I want to say to you, thank you for your service. And it's a selfless act to serve and particularly high levels because you get criticized all the time and you don't make any money and all that kind of stuff. But I want to say thank you for your service.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate that. It really was an honor to serve. And I don't just say that because that's what people say. I really felt it. I felt it at the time I was doing it. I still feel it now. As I've said to other people, it was a pleasure to get to have the opportunity to do it. And I was more delighted at having that opportunity than I am now unhappy about my not being there. I really did feel like my job was primarily as a prosecutor. I was intent on making sure that the statutes that the EEOC is supposed to enforce were going to be enforced in a way that protected all American employees in a manner that was fair to all American employers. And I just want to make it clear that I never was given any marching instructions from the White House when I was in that job. I don't know the extent to which that's interesting to people when they think about whether or not the president should be able to remove somebody from that position. But the president, at least in the last administration, left the performance of that those duties to the person appointed and confirmed to do that job.
Well, as was the case for the many years of precedent I mentioned, that's the way every president, Democrat and Republican, has observed and viewed the office. But I do want to agree with Neil. Sharon, you did a terrific job. You should still be there from my perspective. And we wish you well.
Thank you.
Well, it feels like we're wrapping up. This is Dean, but we're not. We have three questions left. So I'm going to try and get through as many of these as possible. Ask the questioners to be as concise as possible in their questions. So you go right ahead, caller.
I'd like to distract the conversation a little bit because I think the real problem here is that edge cases have become the norm. The examples won't map exactly, but whether it was Scott Pruitt or Wheeler at the EPA, Pruitt had sued the EPA. Wheeler was a coal lobbyist. And these are people that are appointed to undermine the agencies that they're going to work for. Same thing with GOP federal election administrators that the FEC is just paralyzed right now because of the nature of the appointees is such that they are there to undermine the core mission of the agency. And same thing with postal governors that are trying to gut an organization because it competes effectively with private sector operators. And I'm curious, for the folks that don't think there's anything that can be done, aren't you really advocating for destruction of these agencies? If you have people there mold in that are there to undermine the agency, is there any solution to that problem at all?
Might be far afield from our discussion today, but does somebody want to respond to that, Roger or Neil or Sharon?
Well, I mean, I'd be happy to have a discussion about for-cause removal. Back to Pepper's question, at will versus for cause, two obviously distinctly different doctrines. If an individual is not performing the duties that are vested in her or him or required to be performed, then that's a different discussion. That was not the case with respect to Sharon's removal. The White House has never articulated to this day any for cause reason for her removal. Her term didn't expire until August of 23, as I recall. So this was just an absolutely, I think, political move without good policy justification and without good legal justification.
Let's see if we can get a final question in here. Neil, were you going to say something? Sorry.
I'll leave that to Roger. That's good.
Okay. Go right ahead, caller.
Yes, thank you. Great discussion today. My question is about the practical effects of the change in leadership at the EEOC with the general counsel and otherwise. And the question is, in the wake of, say, all the unanswered questions from Bostock versus Clayton County last year, what do you anticipate we're going to see, or what have we already seen from the new EEOC leadership to indicate a change of enforcement or interpretation priorities at the agency?
This is Dean. Let's consider this our final question, and we'll go through the order again and try and ask for brief responses, and you can say anything you want by way of wrapping up as well. So, Sharon Gustafson.
It's not a secret that I was interested in making sure that we were protecting people from religious discrimination. I had heard too many stories for too many years about employees facing religious discrimination and not thinking that the EEOC would help them. So that was a priority of mine. I have heard from people there that some people think that there is some discrepancy between protecting people on the basis of religion and protecting people from discrimination on the basis of their LGBTQ status. I insist that both of these things can be done at the same time, and it was my intention to do both at the same time. I think that in the current administration, there may be good reason for thinking that one of these is of much higher importance to people than others, and that is disappointing and discouraging to me. Religion, it fits right in the middle of Title VII, right in the middle of all the other bases, and needs to be protected just like all the other bases.
Final thought, Roger King.
Well, excellent question, but let's get back to the issue at hand, the authority of the general counsel, and is it of such a high level of authority, as Neil mentioned, that it requires a presidential at-will termination authority? No, I don't think so. And the question that the caller posed is a policy question that will be decided ultimately by the courts, not by the general counsel of the EEOC.
So it's Neil, just sort of the follow.
Neil, let me just interrupt you really quickly.
Before
I give you the final word, we of course could have gotten conservatives to make the unitary executive argument, but I thought it would be more interesting to hear that from you. So I appreciate your participation. And I'll give you the final word to wrap up.
Okay. So thanks. Roger, I'm just not sure it's ultimately true. Prosecutors, I was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, and I, as a prosecutor, I had an enormous discretion about what, particularly that when I was a senior prosecutor, about what kinds of cases to bring, where to focus my attention, and prosecutors are not just scriveners along the way. And the only other issue, and look, I have no idea. I've not spoken to anybody at the White House. I don't know why Sharon was terminated. But I do think that the point Sharon just made is probably more difficult, that accommodating religious freedom and at the same time not letting religious freedom become an excuse to discriminate against LGBT, that is a fraught issue. And I think that Democrats generally have a different view of it than Sharon did. And it's not that they can't both coexist. As Justice Kagan, again, I love her writing, and so I'm going to cite her again. She's talking about the majority on the court now weaponizing the First Amendment, and I'm quite worried that that's kind of where we're headed. And I think we're going to see a different level of advocacy out of the Biden administration on a number of those issues. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for permitting to be on this panel, and thank you, Dean. I've really enjoyed it, and Sharon and Roger have enjoyed appearing with you.
Thank you, Neil and Roger. Yeah. I enjoyed it as well.
I would echo that. And Neil, we're going to remember your remarks 4 years hence for the interior executive.
They're recorded remarks, so no problems with
right.
that. My thanks, this is Dean, my thanks to all of you as well, personally and on behalf of the Federal Society, certainly appreciate it. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for their thoughtful questions and comments. Reminder to the audience, check your emails, monitor our website for upcoming Teleform conference calls, but my insider information tells me our next scheduled call is at 2 p.m. this very day. So with that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.